general, and they need to, you know, give the impression that they're doing something. Hence, they're sending these envoys to the region and writing articles and so on and so forth to at least prove that they are trying to do something. While in fact, in reality, the United States continue to subsidize this war, manage this war, because we see Lloyd Austin sitting along with Yoav and the rest of the Israeli generals. And they're also, of course, as we know, sent the two aircraft carriers and the nuclear submarines to the area, hence shielding Israel, not just militarily, but also at the United Nations, committing $14 billion to Israel's war effort. So all in all, the United States continue to unconditionally support Israel while claiming to distance itself from the intensive phase of the war, claiming that they want to phase out to something different, right? So that's what we have for the time being. But the fact of the matter is that until today, 10 weeks later, the United States is yet to condemn Israel in public, its war crimes in Gaza, yet to distance themselves from those war crimes that have been reported once and again that are taking place in Gaza. All what they're saying is that Israel should try to minimize, because too many Palestinians have died over the past 10 weeks. And now when they talk about the phase out, and here this is a very, very interesting fact that we see. They're saying Israel should perhaps target Hamas fighters, Hamas tunnels, and assassinate their leaders. That's what they're saying. So it begs the question, if this is the way to fight Hamas, why did they go on and destroy Gaza, leading to tens of thousands of casualties the past 10 weeks? There's clearly another way to fight this war, which is going after Hamas, not going after Gazans. But from the beginning, Amy, and this is, again, very important to underline, is the fact that Gaza has been the target of this war, not Hamas. And if you look at the statistics, Gazans, the journalists, the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, the academics, the children have been the main victims of this war. Hamas fighters, Hamas militants have been the collateral damage in this war. For the past 10 weeks, it was Gaza that being decimated, its civil infrastructure being decimated. It's been a war on hospitals, on schools, on mosques, and yes, a war on children. And yet it was unconditionally supported by the United States and other Western powers. And we haven't heard a single retraction for that support. And it's still being shielded at the United Nations. 153 members called for an immediate ceasefire. And what did the United States do? Voted against it. 13 members of the UN Security Councils voted for an immediate ceasefire. Britain abstained. The United States vetoed the resolution. The United States and Britain, until today, they sit isolated in the international community. So when President Biden tells a small group of people in Washington that Israel is perhaps losing the public support, what public support? What international public support? A majority in America, to my knowledge, asked for a ceasefire. A majority of the Americans and out are the Biden administration and his lackeys in London and Berlin. The rest of the international community, including the absolute majority of everyone in this region, wants a ceasefire. And just quickly to cap that, we just interviewed a number of people in Gaza, in the streets in Gaza, asked them, what do you think about Lloyd Austin coming to the area? They said something to the fact, oh my God, this means we're going to be bombed again and again the next few days. Because think about that. Since Biden landed his in the middle of October, every time an American official showed up in Israel, Israel had intensified the bombings. After Biden came, the land invasion started. And every visit by Blinken or Sullivan or Lloyd Austin, we've seen an intensification of the bombings of the civilian infrastructure of Gaza, of the residential buildings in Gaza. That's been the case. That's been the reality. There's no other interpretations of it. So the diagram, the process, if you will, shows unconditional American support despite the various acrobatic verbal diarrhea that comes out of Western capital about, well, we're not very happy about too many Palestinians dying. Well, how many is enough exactly for them to stop Israel from continuing? Because Israel couldn't launch this war. couldn't sustain this war, couldn't survive in the region like this without American support. In fact, Prime Minister Netanyahu says that we will win this war with the support of the United States. So imagine a country that calls itself the most important power in the Middle East is incapable of defeating a small guerrilla group that's been under siege for the past 17 years, and it requires the deployment of aircraft carriers and the financial and military power of the world superpower. And yet, until today, it still insists it's not even done with half of the job. Because despite the tens of thousands of casualties, despite the death of more than 7,000 children, only a fraction of Hamas fighters have been killed in this war. It all goes to tell you that the end game and the military objectives, none of them have been reached despite the genocide that continues to unravel in Palestine.
So Netanyahu holds this news conference on Saturday after the killing of the three Israeli hostages in Gaza. And he says we have to intensify the war to make Hamas release the hostages. What is your response to this? Clearly at odds with even Israeli public opinion. And the idea that these three men who were killed by Israeli forces, Netanyahu saying that his own forces violated the rules of war. Was this any different or any surprise than the way thousands of Palestinians have been treated, many also holding up a white flag? The surprise here is that these hostages were not treated differently than Palestinians.
Absolutely. Shirtless, white flag, and shouting in Hebrew. And yet, they were murdered by their own. Which tells you, according now to a good number of Israelis speaking out, that there are no rules of engagements. It's crap. It's humbug. There are no rules of engagement in Gaza. You shoot whatever moves in Gaza. And yes, it's odd, because the Israelis have been doing exactly that since day one. Now, as you said, it's also odd, his arguments about the captives, because this is the most ridiculous arguments of all arguments. We've known from the beginning that they said the aim of this war is first to defeat Hamas, second to release the captives. And they kind of connected both by saying, if we intensify the war, Hamas will be pressured to release the captives. It never did. So they had to resort to diplomacy, asking the Qataris, the Egyptians, and the Americans to help. And they did. And through diplomacy, they were able to release some of the hostages. And then they went back to war the day after. Now they want to try it again. Well, the news is that Hamas will no longer accept humanitarian pauses. Hamas now insists on permanent ceasefire and the withdrawal of the Israeli forces from Gaza. Otherwise, what incentive does Hamas have in order to release any more of the especially military captives that it has in Gaza? Because if the Israelis, with the support of the United States, are going to continue the bombings the next day, and they insist that the war objective is to kill Hamas fighters, there's zero incentives why they would release anyone. So today, we are in the Netanyahu logic. And the Netanyahu logic is neither in the interest of Israel or the United States. And Biden knows that. Apparently, he got a file from Israel through his intelligence agencies that says something to the fact, according to Haaretz, the Israeli mainstream paper, that Netanyahu has a personal vested interest in prolonging the war. Because he, as a political criminal indicted in corruption charges, come war criminal, he has a vested interest to prolong the war as much as he can in order to improve his chances for re-election. In fact, he just put in the military fatigue and started making his populist slogans the one that we know them, saying that only he can prevent the emergence of a Palestinian state, that only he can stand up to the United States, and hence the Israelis need to elect him again. So Netanyahu, as a person, the military establishment as well, have vested interest to continue with this war.
Marwan Bashara, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Al Jazeera's senior political analyst speaking to us from Doha, Qatar, born in Nazareth in the occupied West Bank. Thanks so much for being with us. Coming up, Nina Lakhani, the senior climate justice reporter of The Guardian. Stay with us.
Acapulco nosso carnaval, ninguém ouve cantar canções, ninguém passa mais brincando feliz, e nos corações saudades e cinzas foi o que restou. O que se vê é uma gente que nem se vê, que nem se sorri, se beija e se abraça e sai caminhando, dançando e cantando cantigas de amor. E no entanto é preciso cantar, mais que nunca é preciso cantar.
March of Ash Wednesday by Carlos Lira, who just passed away. The Brazilian musician died at the age of 90. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After a decade-long campaign, climate activists say more than 1,600 institutions have now cut ties with the fossil fuel industry and divested some $41 trillion in assets. This comes as nearly 200 countries agreed to a deal at the COP28 UN Climate Summit to phase down fossil fuels, replacing language calling for a phase out. Now, a growing number of Democrats are calling on President Biden to stop massive new fossil fuel developments. Meanwhile, in Britain, just days after COP28 wrapped up, climate groups filed a lawsuit to block the development of the massive new Rosebank oil field in the North Sea, saying approval of the project violates Britain's legal obligations to target net zero carbon emissions. For more, we go to London to speak with The Guardian's senior climate justice reporter, Nina Lakhani, who we last saw when we were in Dubai as we both covered COP28. Her latest piece is headlined, Indigenous People and Climate Justice Groups Say COP28 Was Business as Usual. Nina, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Why don't you talk about the fallout of the UN Climate Summit, you know, the head of it, the head of ADNOC, the Abu Dhabi National Oil Corporation, Sultan Al Jaber, who is also the president of the COP, and the taking out of any language of fossil fuel phase out, making it phase down. What all of this means?
Nice to be with you, Amy. I think that last piece you just mentioned, I think that's sort of a summary, I guess, of where we got to. I think on that last day, there were some very happy countries and some very happy industries. So the US, the biggest polluting countries and industries in the world, including the US, the UK, the EU, Canada, Australia, Denmark, Norway, and the fossil fuel industry itself were extremely happy with the result. The language we ended up with isn't even as good as you're saying. All it says is that there will be a transition away from fossil fuels. There is no timeline. There is nothing more concrete than that. And vitally, and why climate justice sort of advocates and experts and Indigenous communities and frontline communities are very much of the view that this is business as usual, is that there is nothing in there about there is no differentiated responsibility. There is no language that basically that acknowledges the historic responsibility of rich developed countries like the US and the UK and others in the current climate catastrophe. And it places no extra responsibility on them to get rid of fossil fuels first or any timeline at all. And in addition to that, again, through pressure from the US and the EU and others, there's actually a huge get out clause. There's a paragraph that says that transition fuels are okay. And by that, they're talking about gas, right? as we know, and you've reported on in Democracy Now, that the Biden administration has been expanding. The US is the biggest oil and gas producer in the world this year by a long way. It also has the plans to expand oil and gas at a much greater and faster scale than any other country in the world. Now, including this transition fuel, which, by the way, is language that comes from the fossil fuel industry, in the text, it basically is a get-out clause to all those countries who are wanting to, to exploit and extract their gas, their gas resources. And just to add one more thing, again, from pressure from the same countries and the same industries, there is an explicit use. They don't use the word unabated, but they do say that they give a big sort of a big shout out, really, to sort of niche, unproven technologies like carbon capture and storage, like hydrogen, like geoengineering, which are expensive. They don't work very well, if at all. And it basically is going to green light further expansion of oil, gas and coal with the proviso that rich countries will have money for these expensive technologies to minimize to lessen the greenhouse gas impact. All of that together is why a lot of, the small island nations, the African group, among many other countries, felt bullied into signing the so-called consensus agreement at the end, but really have been left without any means, without any recognition that developed countries, those that got us into this mess, are going to be the ones that shoulder the burden of funding for the means of implementation to get us out of this mess, to fund a just transition. Really, equity is not anywhere to be seen in that final agreement that we got.
So if you can talk about your latest piece, which involves indigenous voices and what is happening for the global South and who needs to be heard. And if you feel that the fact that they even reference fossil fuels for the first time in a final COP document is in any way an achievement, a success, Nina.
I mean, there's lots of ways to define historic, right, I guess, or lots of ways to see that word. I mean, it is historic in a sense. It's the first time fossil fuels are mentioned after 28 COPs, more than, after three decades of scientists, climate scientists telling us that and warning us that fossil fuels were the primary major driver of the climate crisis, right? So yes, it's historic. It's tragically historic that it's taken this long to get into sort of the COP text. But what does that mean, right? Words are just words if there is no means of implementation. In the Paris Agreement, right, there is, which is a legally binding treaty, it is very clear that developed countries, those that got rich from extracting fossil fuels, like the US, like the UK and others, have a differentiated responsibility to provide developing countries with the means of implementation for mitigation. So that's sort of transitioning away from fossil fuels to renewable energies, climate adaptation and other climate finance. And that, so it means finance, it means technology transfer, it means capacity building. Without the means of implementation, these are just words, right? Developing countries are already facing trillions of dollars in a funding gap in order to sort of finance climate adaptation. On top of that, $400 billion a year in loss and irreversible loss and damage. There is nothing in this there is nothing concrete, direct in this final text. That because developed countries pushed to get it out, they refused to budge on this to make it there, to make it clear that they are the ones that are responsible and must help developing countries transition away from fossil fuels. Let me give you an example. So take Malaysia, right? Malaysia has a national oil company. 20% of Malaysia's national budget, the money that its government uses to spend for education, for health and other public services, comes from its national oil company, right? Take Mozambique, one of the poorest countries in the world, has huge amount of gas. How are we going to tell these countries, or why should these countries stop extracting their oil and gas, right? How can they possibly do that when they're still unable and are still trying to meet the basic needs of their population? They have to be helped they have to be given the help to transition away, to leave these fossil fuels in the ground, and to be able to continue to develop their own countries for the best of their people. We have, you know, otherwise they're just not going to be able to do that. And what developing countries have been saying for years and are still saying is that developed countries who benefited from extracting all these fossil fuels now want us to do more and more and more, right? When they're not willing to do even the bare minimum. Why has the Biden administration green-lighted the Willow Project? Why is it green-lighting massive gas expansion projects, which, by the way, will be a death sentence to communities down in the Louisiana coast, right? Why is the US, which had already benefited so much from extracting fossil fuels, not willing to stop its own expansion, but is demanding that developing countries stop exploiting the resources that they have? There is nothing fair and is nothing equitable in that.
So I want to turn to an unusual voice at the UN Climate Summit in Dubai. While we were there, we spoke to the head of the largest indigenous delegation in the history of the COP. Sonia Guajajara is Brazil's first indigenous cabinet minister. She's the Minister of Indigenous Peoples. And I asked her what she wanted to see coming out of this UN Climate Summit. This is what she said.
For the indigenous peoples, we need to prepare for the road that we need to head down in order to reach COP30, which is going to be held in Belém in the Brazilian Amazon. We also need to prepare so that we can have a direct impact on the debates that unfold here at the COP. And oftentimes, we are not even close to it. It's very important that we indigenous peoples participate in these forums. And there's a group that is directly on top of this. So we are here so that indigenous peoples can have more space in decision making. And the general message is that we have little time left. The big leaders, government leaders, need not only to take on commitments here, but also to understand that we are in a state of emergency. In order to emerge from that state of emergency, investment is needed, financing is needed, and protection so that we can all protect the planet.
President Lula still has plans to do massive offshore oil drilling. As the first indigenous people's minister, do you condemn this move? Are you weighing in on this? Do you support this?
Look, in Brazil, we're at a moment of transition to clean energies as well. We're building that together. President Lula is committed to making that transition. And now we're using what is available to us, such as the wind and the water, so that we can emerge from the energy we're using today based on destruction, and so that we can have renewable energy that protects the peoples and that does not destroy the environment.
So that's Sonia Guajajara, Brazil's first Minister of Indigenous Peoples, a lifelong leader in Brazil's indigenous rights movement. The historic federal ministry was established in January by Lula, the Brazilian president, to advance and protect the rights of indigenous people in Brazil. And Brazil, specifically Belém, is going to be the site of not next year's UN Climate Summit, but the following year. So they had one of the biggest delegations. In fact, I think their delegation outnumbered only two delegations, UAE and Brazil, outnumbered the number of fossil fuel lobbyists there were at UN Climate Summit, right? 2,400. So I'm wondering, if you can talk about the significance of Brazil being host to a UN climate summit. Also next year, the petro-state Azerbaijan will be going to Baku. And also the whole issue of what indigenous peoples face. And you in particular are an expert on this. You wrote the book about Berta Cáceres, the Honduran indigenous rights activist who was murdered in her home. Now Honduran authorities issuing an arrest warrant for the one of the heads, the suspected mastermind of her murder. Daniel Atala Medense, the former financial manager of the hydroelectric company DESA. If you can talk about all of this.
Okay. Let me just start, I guess, with something, you know, just, I guess, a simple fact that sort of gives us context for all of what you're talking about, Amy. You know, what is climate justice, right? You know, we are not all in this together. When it comes to the climate crisis, we are absolutely not all in this together. We didn't all contribute in the same way or in the same amount to the climate crisis. We're not all impacted by it in the same way. And we are not all going to benefit from the solutions in the same way, right? That is the sort of inequity of where we're at in the climate crisis. So when it comes to Indigenous people, and I'm so glad you brought up the fossil fuel lobbyists, you're right. Fossil fuel lobbyists outnumbered the official Indigenous people sort of delegations by 7-1, right? 7-1. There were 1 in 30 of the people that you and I saw walking through these corridors of power at COP28 in Dubai were fossil fuel lobbyists. On top of that, you had big ag, big dairy lobbyists. You had others that were there sort of touting and promoting false tech solutions, others with vested in interests. And many of them, and there were also lots of these groups like the API, the American Petroleum Institute, and ad agencies and PR companies that have a long, inglorious track record in climate denialism and blocking climate action, right? That they had more access to this, to the sort of meeting rooms where decisions were being made, where negotiations were happening, than Indigenous peoples. Indigenous peoples who are at the front line of the climate impacts that the world is facing. They are also the guardians of most of the biodiversity in the world. And they also are the reasons that the planet even still exists. I mean, Indigenous peoples around the world from all different, in every corner of the planet, have lived sustainably with their resources, didn't exploit them for profit, right? Didn't exploit them to get rich. For millennia, since time immemorial. And so they also, and what people will say to you from wherever they're from, is that they have the solutions. They have knowledge and they have the solutions. That yet they are so rarely given a seat at the table. They're so rarely part of a decision-making process. Now, Brazil, you know, is one of the few exceptions. But I think in terms of President Lula and Brazil continuing to expand its fossil fuel extraction, I mean, it comes back to what I was saying before.
Nina, Brazil, we have less than a minute.
Okay. I mean, you know, we cannot, as sitting here in the US or the UK, demand that countries like Brazil phase out fossil fuels, wean themselves off fossil fuels, while we continue ourselves to expand and get rich from them. We have to, you know, we have no moral, you know, authority to do that. The UK, the US, developed countries have to go first, and they have to provide the means of implementation for Indigenous communities and for developing countries to transition away and to really take the climate action that the whole world needs.
And finally, we have 20 seconds. If you want to comment on one of the heads of DESA having an arrest warrant out for him for the murder of Berta Cáceres.
That is huge news. Daniel Atala Medense is from one of the most powerful oligarchs in Honduras, politically and economically powerful. His father and his uncles were the majority shareholders in DESA. And
Nina, so that is a tease for our post-show interview. We're going to post online at democracynow.org, along with our interview with Sonia Guajajada, Nina Lacani of The Guardian. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Le Chablais.